Do you remember the first time that science inspired wonder in you?
Oh, of course. It was a very first visit to my local planetarium. I grew up in New York City, and the local planetarium there is the Hayden Planetarium. And there's this odd room. It's round with a hemispherical ceiling and this creature-looking piece of hardware in the middle of the room, and the light's dim. You don't know what that thing is going to do. Is it going to come out and attack you? But then the splendorous night sky appears above your head. And I was born in the Bronx, New York, where I pretty much thought I'd seen all the stars visible. It was about 11 stars at night. And here were thousands. And in fact, I thought it was a hoax at first, but a very, very enjoyable hoax. And I would later recognize that, of course, that was the real sky. And I was starstruck, really, by it. And I would say that my path to become an astrophysicist wasn't even my choice. I was called by the universe, and that was my first true encounter with what I would call wonder.
Huh. How old were you when that happened?
I was 9.
That's astonishing. I mean, you now run the Hayden Planetarium.
Yeah. You know, that kind of story plays better in, like, rural and suburban areas. A hometown kid comes back and does good. In the city, there are too many stories. No one cares that I'm now director of the planetarium.
But I mean, the fact that that would stay with, I mean, that was such a powerful primal experience. And it, to some degree, I mean, you're suggesting that your life was kind of laid out in front of you from that moment on.
Yeah, I mean, had I not gone until 11, it probably still would have played out the same way. Here's what I wonder, though. Suppose I grew up on a farm. And the actual night sky was there from birth, from my first wanderings out onto the porch. And I wondered, would I ever have taken it for granted, such that a first visit to a planetarium wouldn't have been any different from what I saw from my backyard, and so it would have less impact on me? I always wonder about that. If, in fact, growing up under a real sky would have hampered the likelihood that I would have become an astrophysicist. Because by age 9, you know, I'm a kid, right? And all kids are curious. And I'd never seen the night sky. There it was. It slapped me in the face. And had I been born with it, it would have never slapped me. It would have just been the wallpaper.
Yeah, that's interesting to speculate about. So what do you think happened during that experience when you were 9? Was it just how overwhelming it all was? How surprising?
You hit it exactly. I think, and I've later done some research on this as director of the planetarium, and because we redesigned the entire facility a decade ago, and it's now the Rose Center for Earth and Space, containing the rebuilt Hayden Planetarium. But that whole facility is a huge museum of the universe, and we thought long and hard about what kinds of exhibits are most influential on the visitor. And we leaned away from those exhibit boxes that you walk up to and there's a handle and a lever and a button and there's a screen. And what we found, and what I found personally, but research also shows, that in order for an exhibit to make a completely indelible mark on your memory and on your emotions and on your mind, it's got to be bigger than you are. And that will greatly increase the chances that it'll be unforgettable. Go to anyone who's been to some of the famous museums across the country. So, for example, the one in Chicago, the Museum of Science and Industry. Say, what do you remember most about that museum? Apparently, I haven't been there, but everyone gives the same answer. Oh, it's the coal mine that you go down
right?
into.
It's true, yeah.
That's true. And there's an exhibit bigger than you are. You have to turn your head to up and down, left and right, to see what's going on. And there are sounds and smells, and you're transported. And in a planetarium, it was the first of the sort of virtual reality experiences. You hardly hear that term anymore. But think about it. You are transported into space. You're moving through space. It is bigger than you are. And so I think everyone remembers their first trip to a planetarium. It just happened to have stuck with me, whether or not it has stuck with others.
Well, it takes us back then to your original question, which is, suppose you'd grown up on a farm and the night sky was all around you without the city lights around. I mean, that is overwhelming. I mean, maybe it would be, wallpaper that you were so used to. But on the other hand, I mean, that is the experience of nature, isn't it? I mean, sort of feeling overwhelmed by it.
Yeah, I agree, but I probably what would have happened is I would notice things that would change in the night sky. And that's, of course, what preoccupied the ancients. There's what they call the fixed stars, the background stars. Of course, they're actually moving in the galaxy, but the concept of a galaxy was unknown at the time, and they're so far away, they don't change positions significantly from generation to generation. So what you do notice are the wanderers, what the Greek called the planetes, the planets, where we get the word planet from. And there were seven wanderers, seven objects that moved against the background stars, and there was Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, the Sun, and the Moon. And we trace the names of our 7 days of the week, be they through Roman or Norse gods. That's where we get the names of the 7 days. I guess I would have paid attention to those. And that would have been interesting, too, the occasional comet and the phases of the moon. So I probably still would have been enticed, but it would have happened in a different way. And it wouldn't have been a slap. It would have been a lure. A slow seduction.
Well, all these years later, you are now a very prominent astrophysicist.
Let me add, It took a couple of years between age 9 and 11 before I'd figure out that you could make a career out of that. Because at 9, you're not thinking, gee, I'll have a career. You know, it's just you just do it because it feels good.
Uh-huh.
And by age 11, if you were one of those adults who ask that annoying question, what do you want to be when you grow up? I had the answer. It was astrophysicist. And I'd give that answer, and it usually just ended the conversation right there. There was no comeback on that, but that was fine.
But, I mean, that really is amazing because, I mean, most 11-year-olds, if they do give an answer, they hardly, are still doing that however many years later.
Yeah, I think what we don't appreciate as adults regarding kids is that they are persistently and perennially curious, and it's really forces of society that kind of squash that curiosity. I think it's primarily because that curiosity and wonder is often ends in the destruction of something if you're a kid. I mean, think about it. Suppose the kid is reaching for some delicate plate or, you know, some china on the cabinet, and you say, stop, don't. Whereas had they reached for it and then it fell out of their hands and broke, they would learn about how brittle dishware can be. This is an experiment in material science that gets completely squashed. And so what I try to do raising my kids is recognize that a consequence of their curiosity is the increase in disorder of the household. And provided that the disorder is done in the act of exploration, then I would be cleaning it up after them. And I'd do that willingly and lovingly.
Hmm. So, rather
than telling them to stop.
Huh. So how do you think we can inspire that sense of wonder in kids, specifically through science? I mean, you've already
They already have. That's what I just said. They already have the wonder. My worry is how do we get that sense of wonder back in the adults? The kids are not the problem here.
Huh.
It's, you know, for every adult that says, how can I get my kid interested in science? I said, the kid is already interested in science. It's you I got the problems with. And because adults run the country, they outnumber the kids, they wield resources, adults run everything. And we have a science problem in this country. And so I'm not going to turn to the kids and blame the kids for not being interested in science. I'm blaming the adults. The kids are already there.
So when you say the kids already like science, you're saying they want to know how the world works. I mean, which is
exactly.
What science
That's
is all about.
That's how I should have said it. That's how I should have worded it. The kids are already curious about the natural world. And left to themselves, they will explore it, period. And so the real task of the adult is to get out of their way. That's the real challenge here. And part of getting out of their way is, like I said in that small example, you allow some level of disorder to descend on the house, provided it is the consequence of the curiosity and wonder expressed by the child.
So what happens in school then? Because so many kids are turned off of science in elementary school.
Holding aside that they might have just simply had a bad teacher, which you can get in any field, of course, but holding that aside, the good student in class is the one who obeys the teacher, who is not disruptive, who is quiet when they're told to be quiet, who is seated and not fidgeting when they're told to be seated and not fidgeting. And that is like the opposite of curiosity and wonder. Curiosity and wonder is I have this energy. It's gurgling within me. It's bubbling over. I've got to express it somehow. And so I think this sit down, shut up, learn and take an exam is incommensurate with cosmic discovery.
Of course, you could say that about any subject in school. But for whatever reason, it would seem that a lot of kids just get turned off by science, by the way science is taught, for some reason. I don't know why.
Yeah, and I think it could be because, you know, there's this whole mantra of hands-on activities and labs and things like that. Some of that might be a little overrated, I think, but there's still surely value to learning science by doing it rather than reading about an experiment in a textbook. And the act of doing it, provided you can have fun doing it, provided it's not too recipe-driven, then you can still maintain a sense of exploration and wonder. I've, for example, vowed to not get my kids a chemistry set, because you get the chemistry set and it tells you exactly what to do. Hmm. Well, what fun is that? All right. So what I do is I pull stuff out of, you know, any kitchen is chemistry, right? Whatever you do in a kitchen is some combination of chemistry. So I pull out some ingredients and I just say, have at it. Just combine stuff. See what happens. That's exploration, not following some recipe that someone else already figured out. And then you ape it by mimicking exactly what you're supposed to do to get the result they tell you will happen.
So do you think this experience of wonder is above all an emotional response, or is it something else? Is it more kind of a rational and analytical process of figuring out how things fit together?
No, it's completely emotional, in my opinion. It is completely emotional, and it is the emotion that drives the inquiry. It's the wonder. By the way, you can ask, how did it come to pass that essentially every civilization across time has looked up and created deep and interesting stories about our past, present, and future in the universe? And it's been suggested, I don't know that this has been a study, but it's certainly a plausible idea. When you recognize that humans are one of the few, if not the only mammal, it's completely comfortable sleeping on our backs. We're completely comfortable that way. There's not a fear factor. Back is fine. And we sleep at night. So suppose you go to sleep at night and then you wake up. You confront the sky. And night by night, the sky looks a little different and the planets move and the pattern of the stars shifts from season to season. And so whereas other animals, when they wake up at night, they're facing the ground. They're not looking up. Or other animals might sleep in the daytime and only look for food at night. I mean, we have this sort of unique combination of the likelihood of being awakened at night while you're looking up. And it may be that deep within our DNA, I mean, who knows, but maybe deep within there, it is natural to wonder what's up in the sky. Take a look at what religions do. Typically, they put their gods in the sky.
Right.
They most, except perhaps for the animists, the rest of the religions, the gods are up there. They're in high places. They're in the sky. They're in places where you look up in wonder. And so I'm not surprised. I used to think I was biased that, like, the universe was cool. But no, I'm not biased. It's fundamentally cool, and people who learn about it agree with me. So I think I'm in the right business, actually, for wonder.
So you just talked about how various civilizations have seen gods in the sky. I mean, do you think your sense of wonder through science is comparable to the religious experience of wonder?
Well, that's an excellent question. In fact, I'm on some YouTube video making exactly that analogy in the following way. When I am on mountaintops and I look up, and back in the old days, there'd be pilgrimage to mountaintops because that's where the telescope was. This is pre-internet and pre-remote control over the telescopes. Now you just sit in your office and you point the telescope from your computer. But back in my day, we actually had to go to the telescopes and confront the sky face to face. And in so doing, it's quite it's a moving experience. Just you, the telescope, it's dark, the stars are there, it is eerily quiet. And the emotions that come over me and the words that I use to describe it have quite a bit of resonance with the words I've seen deeply religious people invoke when they've had religious experience. I speak of the majesty of the universe and the emotional being overrun with emotion, just basking in the cosmic glory. You know, there's vocabulary overlap there. And it led me to wonder, led me to wonder whether whether the same part of my brain was getting lit, if you could imagine measuring this with some kind of device. The same kind of my brain was getting lit as what's getting lit by people who have deep and profound religious experiences. And if that's the case, that's kind of interesting to know. And I posed that challenge to neuroscientists. I don't know if they've gotten up on that yet.
Yeah. Well, of course, the other thing that you'll often hear in religious accounts of wonder is the assumption that there's something transcendent going on. I mean, you're tapping into another reality. Maybe the experience itself is transcendent. Is that a word that has resonance for you?
Well, transcendent implies that there's a reality beyond what is.
Oh, we just lost you. Sorry. I need to interrupt for a moment. You just dropped out for about 20 seconds or so. That's weird. So you're back now. You dropped out right after I asked the question about transcendence, whether the word transcendent has any resonance for you.
Transcendence comes with some baggage, I think, that there's a reality that is beyond this reality that somehow you might be tapping into. And my read of the history of our understanding of the universe does not include that kind of sentiment or sense of the world. So no. This notion of transcendence, I've never felt that. I do feel humbled in the presence of ignorance. There's clearly things yet to be discovered in the universe. Dark matter, dark energy. How did life get here? What was around before the universe? Are there multiple universes? What's on the other side of a black hole? You know, there's a lot of questions that remain. And any active scientist is actually drawn to these areas of ignorance because that's the place where discoveries are made. Contrary to newspaper headlines that would leave you thinking that somehow scientists sit with their legs up on their desk basking in their mastery of the cosmos, because you know that they must be the journalist is thinking this because the first sentence is, oh, this new discovery will send them back to the drawing board, or this will upset the apple cart, or this will, well, you know, we're always at the drawing board. We're always staring into things we do not understand. And if you're not, then you're not in the game. So part of the wonder is not only the appreciation of what we have come to discover and learn and understand, but the crossing over between what you know and what you don't know, staring out into that abyss and saying, will I ever be the one who discovers this, or will it await several centuries more of thinkers before we tackle that understanding?
Well, you have a line in your book, which I love. You say, wonder derives from an embrace of the mysterious. And I guess it makes me wonder, what do you think is most mysterious right now about the natural world?
Right. Now, okay, I'm not the first to have those thoughts, but it's a common sentiment among scientists. So right now, like I said, for me, the most profound question, my top three, you might get some variation from one scientist to the next, but this is a really good list of three. Top one is, what is the nature of dark matter in the universe? 85% of the gravity we measure in the universe has no known origin in anything we understand or know or have ever measured. So we measure the gravity, that's it. So we call it dark matter. That's just a holding term. You know, we could just call it Fred if we wanted. It doesn't matter. It's just a term. So that's a mystery, and it's the longest standing mystery in modern astrophysics. Dark matter was discovered in 1937. It's been with us ever since. Another one is the universe is mysteriously accelerating in its expansion against the collective wishes of the gravity of its content galaxies. So something is making that happen that was measured in the late 1990s, 1998. We don't know what's causing that. We call it dark energy. We can call that Wilma. You know, it doesn't matter. Fred and Wilma. There we go. The two profound mysteries in the universe. And I'm still curious about how we go from inanimate organic molecules to self-replicating life. That's a transition we still haven't cracked in the lab, and that's the biologists need to step up on that one. And so I just look in on their window to see how they're coming along there.
Which is obviously, which is profound. I mean, not only for how life first started on Earth, but if there is life elsewhere, you know, how does it start?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And what's clear is that it's not a, when you analyze it, you realize it's not a stretch to recognize that life is based on carbon, because carbon is extraordinarily likable among other elements on the periodic table. So you can, in fact, make more kinds of molecules with carbon than you can all other kinds of molecules combined. So it's an extraordinary fact about carbon, and carbon is plentiful in the universe. And so if you think of biology as the most complex expression of chemistry that we know, that most complex expression would naturally be tapped, have carbon as its driver. So there's certain things that make complete sense when you look at and evaluate the presence and of life here on Earth and the prospect of life elsewhere. What's giving us confidence is that life began almost as soon as it possibly could have in the early Earth. It took probably no more than a couple of hundred million years to go from just sort of molecule soup to life. And the reason why you get that number is the 600 million years, likely around the plus or minus, of the early Earth. Earth was continually being bombarded by leftovers of the solar system. And it's not fair to start the clock then, because it's hostile to complex molecules. The temperature is hot. If you get very hot, you break apart all the experimenting that your molecules are doing. Wait till it cools down, then start the clock. And when you do that, life showed up in a mere 200 million years out of 4 billion. So that's Earth had no problems doing it, even if we have problems in the lab.
Now, you are not only an astrophysicist who deals with a lot of these big theoretical questions, you're also an outspoken advocate of the U.S. space program. Why do we need an active space program?
Yeah, you know, I don't like the word advocate. I think that is what I am, so I'm not in denial of that. But the reason why I don't like the word, because it implies that I have an agenda and I want you to share my agenda. And that's not what I'm about. What I really do is, if you look carefully at my writings and the clips of my talks that land on YouTube, if you look carefully, I'm simply presenting for you the cost of action and the cost of inaction to the American culture, to the American economy, and to the America's future. That's what I'm doing. It's an offering. And I tell you that space exploration has the power to inspire people to want to become scientists and engineers and technologists, the STEM fields, scientists, engineers, technology, and math. It has that power like none other. Do you care that we have more scientists and engineers in our future because you know that their innovations will drive tomorrow's economy? Then a healthy space program, you get that for free, essentially. And so I'm just – it's an if-then statement. This is all I offer people. And we're in a free – at least we tell ourselves we're still free – a free democracy. You elect your officials. I don't petition. I don't talk to politicians. When I do, it's because I was called in. I testified in front of the Senate just a few weeks ago. That's because they read like the first chapter of my book and they wanted to like hear more. So I said, fine, but I'd really rather this message go to the electorate, because it's the electorate that sets the agenda. I don't want the future of America to be according to the whims of one politician versus another. It's got to rest in the hands of the electorate itself. And if the electorate understands that a healthy space program not only stokes interest in people to become scientists and engineers, it spawns a motivation culture so that everybody becomes a participant. Journalists do more stories about space and science and the like. And artists, producers will have more TV programs capturing this, and poets. And it affects everybody whether or not you're professionally in the STEM fields. And that's the culture that can ensure our economic strength going forward.
Now, when you talk about this kind of space program, does this involve sending people out into space? I mean, not just unmanned robotic missions?
Oh, of course. Oh, yeah. By the way, if space were only about science, you would never send people. Because people, you know, they usually want to come back. You know, you got to keep them in 72-degree things. You got to feed them. you know, a robot, they just, you know, splay out their solar panels or give them a little RTG, radioisotope thermal, how's that acronym go? Thermal energy generator. They're fine. So that's if exploring space were only about science, but it's never only been about science. In fact, historically, it's primarily been about geopolitics. NASA wasn't created because the president said, wouldn't it be great if we had a place to explore and did science? No, we were spooked because Sputnik had just been launched a year earlier. And 1957, NASA's founded in 1958. By the way, in the book is the entire document that creates NASA. And it's interesting to see, just to reflect back on that period and what the priorities were as they were put into that document. Sputnik, by the way, people forget, was or maybe perhaps they never knew, Sputnik was a hollowed-out intercontinental ballistic missile shell. And so while people said, oh, wow, they beat us in space, or oh, what a beautiful name, Sputnik means fellow traveler in Russian, you know, but the military knew this is a ballistic missile shell. If they can put an empty shell with a little radio transmitter over our heads, they can put a nuclear warhead there, too. So it was geopolitically motivated, and let's be honest about that. And when you do so, you recognize that our future in space will not be scientifically driven. It has never been scientifically driven. It could be geopolitics. It could be economics. It could be, the asteroid's coming. Let's try to stop our extinction. There's a good reason to go into space as well. And so all of these reasons can be driving and should be driving our presence in space.
So to make this more concrete then, in terms of future manned missions, is the next big mission sending people to Mars?
People like to think about where the next place should go, and I have a slightly unorthodox view. That's not the right word. I have a slightly more stratospheric view, and that is we should not think of space in terms of destinations. We should think of space in terms of capacity. So, for example, when they built the interstate system in the United States, when he brought the idea over here after seeing the Autobahn and being impressed by it, and said, let's build an Autobahn in the United States, but that's a German name, we got to call it something else, because we just finished the Second World War, so we call it the interstate system. That is, they didn't build it, let's just connect New York and L.A. and then go home. No, you connect everybody to everything, and then commerce takes over, and other touristic reasons take over, and economies are built. You want to give people the freedom to go wherever the circumstances require. So I'm a fan of building an entire suite of launch vehicles that some will take you to the near side of the moon, some to Lagrangian points where all the forces balance in empty space. You can build huge structures there. Get that one to the asteroid to deflect it. There might be scientific reasons to go. There surely are scientific reasons to go to Mars. There could be military reasons to go to the moon or mining reasons to go to another asteroid. All of these reasons will surface. And the act of it of achieving these goals will require that scientists and technologists innovate. And it's those innovations that grant the patents, and those are the headlines that occur weekly, and that is the innovation culture that would unfold.
Now, one of the things that we heard from the Apollo astronauts who went to the moon years ago was that it often changed their lives when they look back on Earth. And what they said, I mean, it's really striking what they said. I mean, seeing the Earth as a whole, it was as if some of the sort of petty differences between humans are not so petty, but they seemed to fall away, and they had an appreciation of humanity that they never had when they were just on Earth. Is that important, do you think?
I think it is one of the greatest unanticipated side benefits of space exploration. The fact that you can turn the camera back to Earth, and the very first time that was done, of course, was Apollo 8 at the end of 1968, and there they were doing a figure-eight orbit, a figure-eight loop around the moon, not going there to land. But by the way, that was the first mission to ever leave Earth for destination, and it's under-recognized in that fact, and I've been trying my darndest to get people to feel what that must have meant at the time. Because the photo they took now called Earthrise, the most recognizable photo there ever was of any subject at all. Earthrise. There was Earth sitting there, not as the mapper maker would have us see it, with color-coded countries and borders, but as nature would have us bask in it, where there's oceans and continents and clouds. And it is this, it's this fact that there we were going to the moon and had the occasion to look back and discover Earth for the first time. I just tweeted that this past few days as we moved through Earth Day. Just a reminder that Earth Day was declared in 1970. We're still going to the moon at that time. No one thought of making Earth Day in 1960 or 19, you know. We were on the moon, and then people said, hey, let's have Earth Day. You know the organization Doctors Without Borders?
Yeah.
That was 1971, founded in 1971. Where do you even have the, where does that phrase even gain currency unless you had the occasion to look at Earth without borders? You could imagine someone could have said Doctors Without Borders 1950 or 55. No one thought to give a name that way. So you have an occasion where the space exploration, in fact, influenced our culture deeply. And the banning of DDT, the introduction of the catalytic converter, the unleaded gasoline, the founding of the Environmental Protection Agency, the Comprehensive Clean Air Act, Comprehensive Clean Water Act, all of that occurred between 1968 and 1973. So I think it's no accident that the urge to think about Earth as a whole, the whole Earth catalog, there you go, 1968.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, what they did is they put that picture on the cover.
On the cover. There it is. And so the outlook and the perspective changed. Often people credit the publication of Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, 1962. It was a bestseller. Often people credit that with the birth of the modern conservation movement. And okay, maybe it planted some seeds, but in terms of legislation, no, nothing really didn't kick into high gear until that photo was published. And by the way, we were still at war. Vietnam was still a bloody experience. There were still huge distractions in our culture. But we found the time to nonetheless take a new outlook on Earth. And the follow-on to that was the famous words of Carl Sagan as the Voyager spacecraft had turned back and photographed Earth as this just speck in this void of darkness. And he cast a whole book on that very concept called Pale Blue Dot. And that's in that recitation, as you reflect on Earth, is the continuation of what Earth is when you look back upon it, first from the moon, now from deep space.
Hmm. Let me ask one final question. You are obviously a very effective communicator about science. I mean, you make it really exciting. And one of the things that you do is you tweet a lot. Reproduce some of your tweets in your book. Fascinating facts like stars in the universe far outnumber all sounds and words ever uttered by all humans who ever lived. And another one is, within 2 minutes of flight, the shuttle's airspeed exceeds that of a bullet fired from an M16. Is this part of what it takes to communicate about science today? I mean, as short as tweets?
Thanks for mentioning the tweets. And thanks for the compliment. But let me say, I got good material. You know, the universe makes good material. I'm not a geologist here. You know, I mentioned geology because they're famous for their huge words to describe rocks, and so it makes communication cumbersome. Whereas in astrophysics, our vocabulary is very transparent. You know, big red stars, we call them red giants, you know. Spots on the sun, sunspots. You see, this is how that works. Beginning of the universe, big bang. We're all into monosyllables here because the universe is complex enough. You don't want to lay down a smokescreen to interfere with someone's capacity to embrace what you say. And I chose a set of tweets that were relevant to the subject of the book. And they're scattered throughout the book. I like to think of them as biscuits. Like you earn your way. You slog through the regular text. Now I hand you a tweet as a reward for getting that far.
It's not really that much of a slog, I have to say.
Okay, well, thank you. But what I do is, these tweets are not special thoughts that I have for tweeting. They're thoughts that go through my head every day, no matter what. And so I have a lens. It's the lens of the educator and the lens of the scientist. And the lens, I'm still a kid, all right? I still look up with wonder. And that's all a scientist is a kid who's never grown up, really. That's really what that is. And so I just have thoughts, random thoughts. And so my tweeting is a way for the base of followers to share in my random thoughts. That's all it is. The only effort I put in is to like fit it into 140 characters. And typically I aim for 125. Hmm. But that's the effort. But otherwise, the thought was there in my head anyway. And what tweeting has enabled me to do is to share it with the public. And it turns out to be ideal because another quick one. I'm driving down the street and there's the stoplight. And I'm saying, if we had copper for the basis of our blood instead of iron, then when it became oxygenated, it would turn green. So we'd have green blood. So I wonder then what color the stoplight would be. Because red is danger, right? Because your blood is red. So I just had that thought and I tweeted it. And people said, mind blown, you know. And the people like getting into it. I said, hey, okay, I'll share a few more of these. And so tweeting is as natural as breathing for me.
This is great. Thank you. And if you can hang on just a moment, my producer, Sarah, has a question she wants me to ask. So hang on.
Sure.
Okay. I have to turn that into a question. One final question. Now that you are now director of the Hayden Planetarium, not just the 9-year-old boy who went to his first planetarium show, what inspires wonder in you now?
I don't think about it that way, because inspiring wonder, the way you ask that question implies that there's something I must appeal to continue to stoke the wonder that exists within me. And all I can say is that I don't think it's ever left. You know, I still catch snowflakes in my mouth as I walk down the street. I still see a puddle and ask myself, how high can I jump before I splash into it to see how much of a mess I can? I still do this. And I don't think I've ever grown up, really. And which makes me annoying in some really grown-up meetings that happen in Washington or anywhere else, because I'm just really still having fun with the cosmos. And you know, the certain agencies that say, well, this is serious, we have to have a serious conversation. Well, I'm sorry, I think the universe is hilarious. And so no, I don't need anything to continue to stimulate it within me, because I think it is, there must be something in the chemistry of my blood that maintains that has it course through me every waking moment. And I live it. I don't think it. I emote it. I don't learn it. And
wow.
This is my life.
That is great. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me.